Everyone knows therapy is great for solving problems, but getting therapy has its own problems too, like finding the right therapist, fitting into their schedule, and of course, the cost. Well, BetterHelp can solve those problems. It's totally online and built around your schedule. It's surprisingly affordable too. Connect with a credentialed therapist by phone, video, or online chat, all from the comfort of your home. Visit betterhelp.com to learn more and save 10% on your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.
And we're back for an all-new episode of Keep It. I'm Ira Madison III.
I'm Louis Pertell, and the stench of the Emmys is still on me. I'm fresh from the ceremony. I was there with Jimmy Kimmel Live backstage with Guillermo doing the bit we do every year there, watching the winners walk by. So if I seem extra golden-y, it's because the kiss of Hollywood is still on my neck. Why am I like a poet today? You ever wonder why am I like that?
Did you have to step over his dead body?
I did. Also, what's weird is, so when that happened, I saw his bit he did with Will Arnett, which of course we pitched 450 alternatives for, and they ended up with that one, which whatever, they're funny together. I missed Quinta actually accepting the speech because I was doing this bit with Guillermo. So when people were like, why did he lay down on the speech? I was like, it was a perfectly benign bit. And I didn't realize, oh, he was still on the stage with Quinta when she won her award. I totally missed that part.
He was like the blood in Macbeth.
That's right. Yes. As Variety said, yes, they use the same metaphor.
How was Big backstage?
Well, my particular position is fun because at the Emmys, they have a little kiosk set up for just the winners to walk through. So so they have like whatever, Entertainment Tonight, Access Hollywood and stuff. And then Guillermo has his own little station next to them. And the winners are, of course, really excited to give interviews because the stress of the night is over or whatever. And they're there to like, you know, toast the show and they're fellow cast members and stuff like that. So to be by those people, like while they're brandishing the Emmy, is a lot of fun. Like, for instance, like at the Oscars, you don't really get that. They just talk to, you know, all the main press, you know, at once.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. It's like the firing squad at the Oscars.
But. Yes. Right. You know, yeah. It's like, here comes somebody from Croatia with the meanest question about your face. Yeah.
Well, we're going to talk more about the Emmys this week, obviously. We'll also talk about the state of mourning we're in.
Oh, God. Both of us wearing black. I'm kidding. We're both wearing like rainbow colors.
Well, that's what Jean-Luc Godard would have wanted, because that's who's passing. Oh. I am actually in mourning for.
Yes. He was 93, correct?
Yeah. You know, which of us is masculine and which of us is feminine?
Oh, well, if I'm masculine, that's too bad. So,
me, I'm breathless.
Yeah, that I see. Yes. Ooh, Gene Seberg, we salute you. Marshalltown, Iowa's own.
I'm Jean-Luc Godard's breathless, and you're Madonna's I'm breathless.
And Madonna famously obsessed with the movie Breathless, which is why she was named Breathless.
Is that what she was named it in the movie?
She is fucking obsessed with that movie. It comes up a lot, yeah.
I think you can see that, you know, in WE.
Oh, sure, definitely. I know we've talked about this before. I think she is the best part of Dick Tracy, a movie that otherwise sucks.
I like Dick Tracy, but I was...
It would be very off-brand if you didn't like it, yeah.
I was especially enamored with her in that film. She's giving it.
Oh, yeah. Also, those songs, you know, I know we both love that soundtrack.
Yeah.
Back in Business, More, great songs.
But no, the Queen died.
Oh, yeah, so, right.
Yeah, we'll talk about her. And we'll talk about my new queen, Camilla, up in the castle.
I have to say, you just say doing shows. What kind of shows? I will say, no, I support any British woman who has the same silhouette as Christine McVie. And that is always what Camilla Parker Bowles has been. So,
sometimes side chicks do win.
That's right. Oh my, isn't that beautiful?
She played the long game.
Right. I mean, I would say we should call this the Angelina rollout.
I mean, truly imagine waiting out your man, picking someone else.
Right.
Having children with him. The British public loving her and hating you.
Right.
Her dying.
Tragically.
You getting married to him. People still hating you.
Right. You don't win anytime. Yeah.
His mama has taken like 12 Land Before Time sequels to die. And now you are finally up in that throne.
With King Charles and also the day after his unsightly fingers are unleashed on the public too. So now it's like your man is extra, like, we're not obsessed with him at the moment either. So
she's really been through it. She's the true heroine of this story. I want to see, I get, you know what, we'll talk about this. We'll talk about this.
Okay.
But you know, we've seen a lot of we've seen a lot of biopics about the crown and the royal family. And I'm like, where's the definitive Camilla?
Right. No, Pablo Lorraine, get on this. Yeah. We had we got a lovely performance as Camilla from Emerald Fennell. Again, we'll get into this.
Yeah. But I want the Camilla biopic.
Yeah. Come on, Kitty. What's that woman who writes all those biographies? Kitty Wells? I forget her name. Andrew Morton. You get all these people. Get on it.
Olive Kitteridge.
Olive Kitteridge. Yeah, Frances McDormand, if you could get on this.
Also, to keep things British, this week I am joined by Edward Innenfall, the editor-in-chief of British Vogue, to talk about his new book, A Visible Man. It's his memoir. We will be right back with more Keep It. The 74th Primetime Emmy Awards aired Monday night, hosted by Kenan Thompson. The big winner of the night was HBO. But my personal favorite winner of the night was Miss Cheryl Lee Ralph.
Oh, my God. And first of all, let me just say, I predicted that win. I'm sure you predicted it, too. But
yeah,
I said, when that happens, something explosive is going to happen. Now, last year we had Hannah Waddingham win, and as I noted at the time, that woman is a true freak. She will scream and, you know,
unique.
Yes, right. she's West End theater girl. Like, there's no rules over there. Cheryl Lee Ralph, somewhat similar, a theater girl herself, you know, underrewarded in terms of actual accolades over the years, but beloved. She was on Keep It recently, a wonderful guest, wonderful time talking to her. And I knew we'd get something classic. I did not know we would get something Verdi's Aida level.
You did not know we would get Diane Reeves's Endangered Species belted as soon as she hit the stage.
When she had people Googling right away, I love a speech that gets people Googling. What the fuck is that?
Inclusion writer.
Frances McDormand again. Wow. Is she paying you this week?
I'm on her payroll.
Okay.
Yeah. No, the speech was marvelous. And, you know, yes, like we said, she was on Keep It. And I profiled her for The Cut recently.
Yes.
And it was in her home. It was just a joy to see it. You know, and it's nice when everyone in the room is like happy for the winner.
Yeah. Also, it's like that happens in those categories, you know, when like a Louis Anderson wins or a Henry Winkler, you know, it's like typically tends to be a supporting role. This person who's been around forever has no like everybody loves them. They have no missteps in their past or whatever. And they finally, you know. I do not mean to say that about Louis Anderson, by the way. I can think of a misstep or two in his past. But when Cheryl Lee Ralph won for Abbott Elementary, for a minute, she looked like she was at a complete loss for words. And I thought we were going to get one of those, you know, Anna Paquin Oscar wins where someone just gets up there and like nervously smiles. And then we got the opposite, which is somebody had prepared an aria for us.
It's always so interesting when you think about moments like these because there's obviously so many fucking great talents in Hollywood, you know, and a lot of them, you know, are like women and people of color. And just to see like everyone cheering that when they win an award, like finally,
yeah,
you know, and then you think about the people, you know, walking around with multiple awards who didn't really need them.
Right. Sure.
The entire Modern Family cast.
Well, by the way,
around.
Which reminds me actually of this Emmys telecast, because what you mostly got was a bunch of repeat winners. You know, like Succession has won before, Ted Lasso has won before, and I don't think there's a person on this earth who thinks this season was as good as the first season of Ted Lasso. You know, you got Julia Garner winning again. I think this time because we threw her in a dungeon with Madonna for a couple hours recently, and we were scared for her.
Murray Bartlett. That was a fun win.
Now, okay, here's my question about that. This is like a philosophical question. Would you pick him to win from that cast? Because let me say something. He was great on the show and memorable and like a bitter older gay guy, which I believe is an underrepresented demographic in pop culture. Please watch the movie Bros, by the way, where this will be represented yet again. Cute film. The reviews are out, as you all know. But Murray Bartlett, did he win? And this is a spoiler, so if you're still intending to watch The White Lotus, you better shut this off and not ask me about it. Did he win because that character died?
I think he won because that character did drugs and ate Lucas Gage's ass.
You think the ass eating was what ultimately did it?
I think people remember that character,
yeah,
to be honest. And I think when you look at this category, it's a lot of unmemorable things. I mean, I'm sure Dope Sick was good to whoever watched it.
I have to say, I was happy for Michael Keaton. I'm like, I don't know that I know somebody who watched Dope Sick. And my girl, Mare Winningham, is in that. So I've got to get on that.
And, you know, Steve Zahn and Jake Lacey are fun in The White Lotus. I would actually say, like, Jake Lacey's, like, probably my other, like, favorite male who was in the show. Like, he was mesmerizing,
yeah,
as an asshole in that. But Murray was just like, he was dominating the culture for a minute, you know, like that role was really good. And Seth was fine, but you know, we didn't really care for Pam and Tommy. So
right. But I will say Steve Zahn in that show, memorably, like a word I would not use in any other context. I feel like this is in the character description. Such a cuck. That I thought that was very memorable and very in the spirit of the kind of spineless whiteness at the core of White Lotus, like sort of like centrally what that show is about.
Mm-hmm.
That said, I love Murray Bartlett. It just reminds me of, for instance, one year, this guy who was on Damages, Jellico Ivanek, who is also on like True Blood and stuff. He won for Damages. And throughout the series, you're waiting for him to have this Emmy-winning moment. And then finally, something is revealed about the character, and then he kills himself, which, of course, is bracing, and you see it on the screen. But I always wonder, are we mistaking a character dying for good acting? Sometimes I wonder.
And while he didn't win, Jared Harris was nominated for Mad Men, you know, after Lane Price committed suicide.
Right. That's sort of typical of what would win the supporting category or a guest, our kind of drama, for example.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, that's why, you know, I think people should give Friends more credit, you know, because I think that like every guest star who won on that show, you know, they die in their episode. Like Friends is a more morose show than people give it credit
that's
for.
Right. When Phoebe shoots Glenn Close right on the show. I have to say that the audience was clearly stunned.
Obviously, Jennifer Coolidge also won for The White Lotus, and that was a great moment because another woman that like everyone loves.
Yes, very same band. And I think the word moment is correct because she was on stage for seemingly seconds before they pulled the cane on her.
They said, get off, bitch.
Now, here's the thing. If you're the producer, here's my question. And Jennifer Coolidge is up there and she is being funny, but she is also slightly discombobulated, like kind of like trying to get to the beginning of her speech. Do you play the music?
Absolutely not.
You just let, okay, if you're the producer, you would just let it go?
I'm like,
you got the suits breathing down your neck. You're like, okay. Time is money, Ira, they're saying. And what's happening inside your head?
A speech like that is like, I don't know, sixes and craps, okay? You let it ride.
You, first of all, you're going to run this number like the craps table in Guys and Dolls, first of all. nicely Johnson over here.
Well, listen, the Emmys is the oldest established permanent floating award show in Hollywood.
Yes, very red. Shout out to my girl Gene Simmons in Guys and Dolls, by the way, while we're on this topic. Anyway, yeah, that said, when they played her off and then she danced to the music, come on. That's somebody who's been in 8 Christopher Guest movies, like just rolling with it. So funny.
I think we have another Modern Family on our hands. Ted Lasso.
Right.
Enough is enough. And it is wild that I'm saying enough is enough after a second year of wins. And like, I think we remember I was a Ted Lasso stan.
Right.
Like, I was proselytizing for this show, okay? I was showing up at people's homes with pamphlets.
Right. Telling them what soccer is, because we're still confused here.
Yeah, and quirky homespun humor.
Yeah, right. So,
you know? And now I'm like, I'm back to that thing where I'm like, yeah, the Emmys really just does like, they hook onto a show and then they keep giving it to people. You know?
Well, let me say about that. I do respect that, because what that means is you actually did like the show. You know, it's not, we're giving it to people because it seems appropriate or it's quote unquote time to move on. It's like, if somebody is giving a great performance on a show, why wouldn't you keep rewarding them? You know, I mean, it might not be fun for the home viewer or thrilling or unexpected, but like the expected is also right in terms of a performance that keeps going, you know?
True. And honestly, listen, like no one is actually delivering a better lead actress in a comedy than Jean Smart right now.
Totally.
In Hacks, you know, like, and no one's scripting a role for someone to do it.
Right. No. So, nobody has a problem with Jean Smart winning. Absolutely not. Please.
Yeah. And it was actually nice to see Lee Jung Jae win for Squid Game.
Yes.
He was so good. Like, he was really what pulled you into that fucking show, you know? Like, amazing. And beat out, you know, all the other people that you'd expect.
Also, Squid Game did deserve something. The scale of that show, like, just what it accomplished, it needed something. So,
and it was like the biggest show. It's still why I feel like Tom Cruise could get an Oscar nomination. I'm like, Squid Game was the biggest show, you know, and it's like it was television the past year,
right?
Just like Top Gun Maverick is brought back movies.
Succession right now definitely is the new West Wing, and that we're sort of making our way around to all the ensemble members getting their moment on the Emmy dais. And I felt particularly vindicated that Matthew McFadyen, our Mr. Darcy, finally got the win. I mean, that character is so great, and to me, I consider it comeuppance for the fact that Pete Campbell and Mad Men never got the Emmy. So to me, this is Vincent Kartheiser rising.
Also, shout out to Brian Cox, who after Succession won for Best Drama, was asked if Succession is gonna like come back again. He's like, we haven't been renewed for season 5, but he doesn't want it to. Hold on, I don't know if there will be a 5th season. No one's had their contracts renewed. Who knows how long it will go on? We don't want it to overstay its welcome, like Billions. That's past its sell-by date.
In your face. Whoa.
He is such a cunt, and yes. I love it.
Oh, my God. Also, like, I mean, yeah, this will have aired by now, so I can talk about this. Brian Cox stopped by our little kiosk backstage with Guillermo, and I don't know why we chose this for him, but we made him take a which Succession character are you BuzzFeed quiz. So he's, like, scrolling on an iPad and picking things. This man on camera, he's like, which Hogwarts house are you? Hufflepuff. It's like so crazy to see. And he goes for it. And by the way, he does it twice and doesn't get his character either time. He gets Connor and then he gets Tom, which is very funny because those are the two characters you definitely don't want to be. But no, I love just the owned bastardliness. Bastardliness. Mm-hmm. We used to have this in Hollywood, you know, the Peter O'Toole's. Yeah.
Yeah. You know, my favorite country song, Where Have All the Bastards Gone?
Oh, yes. Paula Cole. That's exactly what she was wondering. Every episode of Dawson's Creek.
And the answer was Dawson.
They're right here, Paula. Jesus.
Justice for Pacey.
Yeah.
If they rebooted that, I'd like have Dawson dead and it'd just be Pacey's Creek.
I think that's what everybody wants. I feel like when you talk about that show, Pacey comes up immediately and then everyone just stops talking about it. Did anything else happen at the Emmys that we were obsessed with?
I'm obsessed with the fact that Saturday Night Live is still winning Outstanding Variety Sketch Series. And also the fact that there are only two to nominate, that and a Black Lady Sketch Show. But with those two nominated, people were just like, sure, SNL.
Yeah, right. Well, it's like John Oliver winning Variety Show again. We were standing backstage and people were like, oh, do you think this is our year? And everybody exchanged glances like, are you a fucking idiot? Absolutely not. A little Fig Newton's going to take Oliver. It again. Yeah.
I loved Lizzo winning.
Yes. Okay. I have a question about that show. Does it exist?
Every time I log onto Amazon, there is an ad for it.
Okay, that doesn't mean they actually filmed it, or that you can actually click on that. So, who's to say?
Well, I mean, like, the title lives up to itself, though. I'm watching out for the big girls.
Right.
But I'm not watching.
Watching the big...
Watch out implies you're just noticing them.
Right.
Doesn't imply that here. I need to watch it.
Yeah, right. They're over there.
And shout out to Zendaya for just being Zendaya.
Also, I guess she's 11 foot seven.
She's tall. She's tall, baby.
She walked on through and I was like, it was giving like eight children in a trench coat. I was very confused.
She does put on a heel, but like, I have a photo of like with Zendaya and like Jeremy O'Hara at like the premiere of Euphoria, the original season. And like, no joke, like, is right up to where we are.
Whoa. That's mind-boggling. Also, you know, Gina Davis won a special Emmy, and mm-hmm. that was like the last time we had an 11-foot-4 actress, and I really missed that. You know, like the Sigourney Weavers, the actresses where we knew their trench coat sizes when they were on screen. Mm-hmm. That's what I miss.
And anyway, Zendaya deserves a win as long as she is trapped in that basement acting out Sam Levinson's fantasies.
Yeah, she's won two now. Most of the people that, like, Brett Goldstein won his second, Julia Garner won her third. Yeah, lots of repeat winners tonight.
Yeah, well, I think that's the Emmys. Also, like, shout out to just like the point we are in our careers now where half the people we see like the Emmys broadcast are just our friends now.
I do have to say, I want to say it's cool to see whomever, Bowen Yang up there. And yet also I'm like, but what happened to untouchable glamour? These are just people who hang out with me in Palm Springs. What? I sort of miss it.
Well, I mean, that's what happens when we peek behind the curtain, you know? Does anyone who actually knows him thinks like Leonardo DiCaprio's glamour?
Right. That's true. I mean, I saw that we all remember the Dancing Coachella video, and I want to say that told the whole story, but
and I mean, like, my baby, my husband Andrew Garfield, you know, glamorous to us, but you know, I'm sure he's just sitting around talking about Great British Bake Off or something with everyone else who really knows him.
Right.
What does he think actually? I wonder what Andrew Garfield thinks about.
Oh, I think all British people are, I don't know about brilliant, but the word of the hour, bastards. So I'm sure he has big opinions about who sucks. I bet he has lots of opinions about Don't Worry, Darling. I want to hear them.
I just want to launch. I wish we had Don't Worry, Darling stuff to talk about this week.
I know. You would think we do. I mean, we were deeply fed. I was like patting my stomach like Henry VIII.
How pissed off do you think Warner Brothers is that movie didn't come out on Friday?
Right. No, no kidding. Wait, before we forget, what did you think of Keenan as host?
I thought Keenan was good. I love Keenan.
The opening number with like the dancing and stuff, I felt I was watching a teacher's assembly. You know, the teachers have come together to present the history of the Emmys for us. But you know what? It was cute. By the way, have a quaint award show. I don't need it to be naughty or scandalous right up top.
Well, you know, I think the scandal came from Gerard Carmichael's outfit.
No, that's true. Yes. The Kodiak bear that perished so that he could wear that. I lament it.
Skin the bear from the Polar Express.
Yes. Which, by the way, among bears that need to die, that one is number one. Because that movie is an F.
Yeah. Him, but not the Coca-Cola bear. I love him.
Oh, please. No, he's on our side. But, like, the Polar Express will go down as the first of, like, Tom Hanks's, like, six very dubious decisions. And he's made, like, four of those in the past year now. So, just keep it in mind.
I think we've lost Tom Hanks, unfortunately.
Yeah.
You know, the movie roles, the Chet Hanks of it all.
Right. Chet has taken over.
I don't know. Mm-hmm. I mean, I've heard very good things about the new Julia Roberts and George Clooney film. And I'm like, who is going to free Tom Hanks and just put him in a comedy again?
Right. Yes, please. Date somebody who runs a bookstore again. This is what we want from Tom Hanks.
Be quirky. He was like accessible quirky. Quirky, but like a quirky white man, but you didn't think he was going to like blow up a building.
Yeah. He had a conscience, a little bit of neurosis, and then on the side was pretty funny.
Yeah. Anyway, the Emmys just made me miss Tom Hanks.
There we go. Yes.
All right. When we're back, I'm joined by Edward Innenfall to discuss his new book, A Visible Man. Keep It is brought to you by Hinge. Hinge is the dating app designed to be deleted.
If you're really good at it, that is. I've actually met several really good friends through Hinge. I've used it, I can't believe this, over a decade now. Woof, what a life I've had.
Well, you know what they've added within a decade of us being on Hinge is their new LGBTQIA plus prompts, which are designed to help queer daters better connect based on similarities, interests, and compatibility.
Hinge prompts helps you show off your full personality and connect with someone who appreciates you. Plus, these prompts were created in collaboration with GLAAD, so they are by the people, for the people. Some of the prompts are, the first time I knew I was gay was, I was literally in the act of being gay, like hooking up with somebody when I admitted it. Denial is strong and hard in the Catholic Midwest.
Mine was Tom Cruise's Vanity Fair cover, the shirtless one.
You just turned to an imaginary camera and said, I'm gay.
Yeah, I broke the fourth wall.
You're like Fleabag. Other prompts include, I feel proudest of who I am when, it feels affirming when others, blank, I connect to my community by, I wish I could tell the younger version of myself. I'm going to say, whenever I watch that in a Drag Race semifinal, when they're like, if I could talk to my younger self, I would say, I would be like, girl, get tighter clothes. I mean, what's going on with what you're wearing? You look like you're in the X Games. Other prompts include, my chosen family is the best at, and gender euphoria looks like. Download Hinge and show off your full self using their LGBTQIA plus prompts today. Then find someone worth deleting the app for.
Black Stories, Black Truths is a celebration of blackness from NPR and how I live my life every day.
Oh, I'm glad to bear witness to it.
Each of NPR's black voices are as distinct, varied, and nuanced as the black experience itself. In the Black Stories, Black Truths collection, you'll hear stories of joy, resilience, empowerment, and creating world-shifting things out of a struggle.
It sounds like you at Coachella. I'm already tuned in. Every episode is a living account about what it means to be black today, told from a unique black perspective, from Bobby Shmurda to The Wire, Michelle Obama to reparations. There's no limit to the range of Black Stories, Black Truths.
Black perspectives have always been centered in the telling of America's story. Now they are the story. In NPR's Black Stories, Black Truths, you'll find a collection of some of NPR's best podcast episodes celebrating the Black experience. Hear a feed of episodes from across NPR's podcasts that center Black voices. It's NPR Noir. Turn on NPR today and hear a range of voices as varied, nuanced, and Black as the country we reflect. Stories should never be about us without us.
Doesn't the Black experience sound like a three-disc Prince album we never got? Someone check the vault, please. Listen now to Black Stories, Black Truths from NPR, wherever you get your podcasts.
You like to watch new stuff, right? Well, go to Hulu and see what's new, because Hulu has new stuff all the time. like Vanderpump Villa, the new docudrama starring Lisa Vanderpump, where first-class luxury meets world-class drama. A new season of The Kardashians, starring The Kardashians, of course. And Grand Cayman, Secrets in Paradise, the sizzling new reality show set in the tropical Caribbean. It's all new, and it's streaming now on Hulu.
He is the editor-in-chief of British Vogue, and his new book, A Visible Man, A Memoir, is out now. We are delighted to welcome to Keep It the ever-inspiring Edward Innenfall. Hi.
Hi, thank you for having me on your wonderful show.
Yeah, thank you for being here. the first question I want to ask, what does it mean to be the editor-in-chief of British Vogue? Like, what does that entail? I feel like our listeners here, we know American Vogue, yeah. We know what we've seen over the years, but, like, what does that mean for you?
I mean, you could say it's similar to what Anna Wintour does at American Vogue, which is you oversee the content of the magazine, the photo shoots, the words, basically the whole magazine. But the brilliant thing now is it's not just the magazine. So you oversee also the website, the digital content, entertainment, a whole not just a magazine anymore, it was just a whole brand.
Yeah, it's everywhere. Yeah. And I mean, Fashion Week just ended too. So I'm assuming you're still in New York, having recovered from Fashion Week. What does Fashion Week look like for you?
I mean,
And what did this year look like as opposed to the previous years, especially coming out of quarantine and all of that?
I mean, for a long time, we didn't see each other. You know, Fashion Week had to be halted. The industry pivoted to video. So there was a lot of video designers showing by video, but now it's back full steam. The New York shows, everybody was there, and you had a feeling people wanted to be together again. You know, designers wanted to be together again, mm-hmm. And it's a great chance for designers to show the message when you're there at their show, as opposed to sometimes maybe a mm-hmm. video. So it was really nice. The togetherness was good. You know, we've been separated for so long, so yeah, no. The energy was good.
How do you feel like the separation has added to the fashion world? And what do you think, maybe is missing since the, time when people work together?
Yeah, I mean, I think, creativity sort of needs connection, human connection, right? So I feel like a lot of people came back more inspired than ever. Mm-hmm. But the beauty now is that you don't have to have a runway show. You can also say, I'm going to mm-hmm. show a video. I'm going to make a film. Because mm-hmm. that's what COVID taught us. So shows, videos going hand in hand, really a new way forward for the industry. So if you're, young designers can now also have a say. If you don't have money, just have a major video.
Mm-hmm. Just to wrap up, I guess, fashion week stuff, were there any newer sort of designers that you were really inspired by this time, and who sort of shocked you from, the expected people, the old guard, but who sort of still gave you this is something new I wasn't expecting?
I mean, I have to say there was something always quite exciting when a designer like Kim Jones at Fendi comes to New York mm-hmm. and designs a collection with Marc Jacobs. I never thought I'd see that in my sort of my life, but it was really, really great how two sort of titans of the industry can kind of come together and create a New York moment. You know, there was the Evangelista on the runway. It was quite a moment. So I think that for New York was amazing. And then there was a Vogue World Show, Vogue had a show where all the models.
Yeah, I saw the clips from that. Yeah. That looked fantastic.
It was quite fantastic. Yeah. So I think that was good. And then you had, your young designers like Telfar and a host of other, I really don't like to single young designers. So I feel like they all work so hard. Mm-hmm. But it was a great moment. Yeah. I felt like the energy was amazing in New York, really.
Mm-hmm. When you look at designers and, you know, who's going to be featured in Vogue, not just in the pages, but maybe on the cover, you know, in styling, like one of the like iconic covers you have. What goes into that process? Is it, does the celebrity and their team have a say? Is it who you choose to style or shoot the cover? You know, like we see Beyonce on the cover, yeah. You know, like who decides what Beyonce is wearing, you know, who decides what Naomi's wearing on her cover, you know?
I mean, normally, you know, as an editor on those, both of those shoots, you kind of work out an idea, you know, you go back and forth with Beyonce, with Naomi, okay, this is the kind of idea, we're thinking we should do this photographer, here are the clothes, and of course, you know, you have also, sometimes you have sort of advertising, to think about advertisers to think about, or sometimes you can just be like, let's just do Christopher John Rogers. That's just a new moment. Mm-hmm. Just like whatever moment suits that picture, I think. Like Beyonce on a horse, you know, you need a major silhouette. So it's like, let's do a liar. And then Naomi with the baby, you know, you have the baby, so you need a Valentina. So it's nice to have a movement on a shoot. It's not like set, we're doing this. And if it doesn't work, we still have to keep forcing ourselves. We must be able to pivot.
Mm-hmm. What's it even like with the process of who's going to be on a cover? I love when people try to figure out like who's going to be on any of the Vogue covers. And it's usually by who has like a movie coming out or who's getting married or, you know, who has an album coming. And I assume you like have a calendar of looking at those items. But then there's also people where it's like you just, you know, they get a cover because this is a moment for them.
I mean, I always say, you know, whoever is reflecting the zeitgeist. So yes, it could be a movie coming out, an album coming out, or it could be that you just want a shock. You know, like I remember in lockdown, you know, they said all 60-year-olds should stay at home. We're like, here's Judi Dench. She's 85. Or we put essential workers on the cover because they were out there, you know, putting their lives on the line. So here they were, real people. So I think sometimes you just got to go with the zeitgeist as well. Of course, there are always people lined up. You know, getting a Vogue cover, thank God, is still an amazing thing for most people. But you should be able to sort of surprise a bit. Element of surprise. So the zeitgeist and elements of surprise as well, I'll say.
Yeah, and I mean, you know, what goes into... You talked about a New York moment before, you know, for like Fashion Week and those things. What would you describe as sort of a... What's a British moment, you know? Because like... You know, I'm an American, so like, what's a moment, you know, you, when you're at cover, you're like, well, this means something for the UK specifically, you know, like the cover with the Queen, you know, earlier this month or something, or thinking of how you're going to honor her too, now that she's passed.
Yes. I mean, you know, the British moment is always sort of a very, very creative moment. Britain is not necessarily, you know, we don't have the biggest sort of industry when it comes to, you know, like, huge houses, but we have young designers who get plucked by the world. So you think of McQueen, you think of John Galliano, you know, J.W. Anderson, they start small. So England is almost like a hotbed of ideas. So that's always a British moment will always take your breath away. It's always like, you know, let me take this and let me cut it and let me deconstruct it, let me put it together. You know, it comes from a need. You know, there's not much money in Britain, you know, design. So it's the need to be creative. So that's one thing. And the Queen, you know, the head of, you know, she's our head of state and she's passed. And, you know, for the next, it's 5 days now, but for 10 days, the country's in mourning, you know. And we all sort of action is seized on the British Vogue sort of website, a lot of websites, just really paying tribute to this woman who gave her life, sort of, of service. So the country's really in mourning.
Mm-hmm. And she gave fashion moments too. You know, you look over at the history of like the photos. Yes.
We did something in the magazine once where we had the Queen in all the different rainbow colors that she wears, those coats. Incredible. Mm-hmm. I mean, such a great style. You know, it's influenced so many designers from Miuccia Prada to Marc Jacobs. You know, her style was really, really unique.
Brief aside, like, how did it feel being wrapped up in your wedding festivities and then the initial report where it was like the queen had died months ago, when it was like, but on the way to your wedding, like, what did you even think about hearing that?
I'm just like, who made that story up? It was insane. You know, there we were, you know, it was quite a closed wedding outside of London at my friend's sort of ancestral home, Longleat. So we were in a bubble. And then, can you believe, we come out of the wedding the next day and I see that the queen had passed on the way to my wedding. Someone said to me yesterday, oh my God, you killed the queen twice. I'm like, it was all falsities. I've never met the queen. She was not on her way to my wedding. But that became a story. I don't even know where it came from. I would have loved for her to come to my wedding, but unfortunately she wasn't.
Yeah. I mean, the wedding did look gorgeous. I feel like that's such a picturesque place for a wedding. I have two friends who just got married recently in Oxford at Blenheim Palace. And when you're there arriving, it just feels like the English countryside, something about it just says wedding.
Oh, the English countryside is quite pretty amazing. And you know, and the locals, sort of the village around the wedding, everybody was so excited, you know. And you do bring a lot of money into the economy because a lot of people have to book hotels and, you know, places to stay and places to eat. So it was a really great moment, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Right. Well, let's talk about your history a bit. In this book, you know, I was really intrigued by the stuff you were writing about, you know, your time at ID, you know, like when you were first coming up, you know, in the city. How do you look back on, you know, sort of what you learned then? And what was it about, like, the energy of the fashion world then as opposed to now?
I mean, I started at ID sort of very, very late 80s, early 90s, you know, and we really didn't even know there was a fashion industry in Paris or New York or Milan. And we just wanted to sort of create images that reflected our realities, which was we go down the market, you take the clothes, you put it together, you try to out-customize each other. But I remember being at ID, I started when I was fashion director when I was 18. And my God, I had to do everything on my own. I didn't have an assistant, but the beauty of that time was I would work in the art department. I will shoot a cover, style a cover, write the shopping pages, run around London trying to get tidbits, do the ID club nights, be in advertising, learning how to sell. And you know what it did? It gave me the perfect insight into how to run a magazine, which is really helping me today. Mm-hmm. But at the time, I just did it to survive. I was so young. I'm like, I'm not going back home. You know, I'm going to make this. And the energy at the time was amazing. You know, you have people like Kate Moss starting out, Naomi Campbell, you know, designers like John Galliano. And we were all like, you know, how do we make London happen after the big 80s excess, you know? So, you know, we did grunge, you know, which was like a rejection of anything that was 80s inspired. And we just helped each other, really looked after each other. And the energy was wild. We went out all the time. We never stayed at home.
Yeah.
You go out and then you go to
work. Yeah. What were like the hot spots of then? Are any of them still around? I'm sure most of them are gone.
They're all gone. There was the White Club. There was the Mud Club. There was the club called Shoom. There was the Ministry of Sound. I mean, you name it. And we were at every one of them. Every single one of them. I remember my friends and I, because we all worked together and we all sort of played together. So we will all go out and just drug ourselves from a club, shower, and then go to work. That's what we did.
Yeah.
You know? Don't have the energy now.
I love just like, I love hearing about just that era, because you even think about, you know, the fashion then, you know, pre even like MTV, pre like, you know, networks airing things all the time where you could sort of get them globally.
Yeah.
Like, Imagine what it was like finding out about a new designer, or like how people would get their stuff across the pond.
Yeah. I mean, you know, finding out about American designers, you had to rely on your friends a lot. You know, we have lots of sort of like-minded people out across the pond who were like, oh my God, Bessie Johnston just dropped this, or this young American, and we'll be like, oh my God, we have Judy Blaine, we have House of the Beauty of Culture. And there were only two magazines really in England that dealt with underground culture. One was ID and one was The Face. And then I think in America, you had like early issues of Details. And, you know, you had Susan Bartsch throwing these incredible parties, and they'll come to London. Mm-hmm. I remember going to one of Susan Bartsch's parties, kids dressed up, and I saw for the first time a drag queen on stage, and it was RuPaul. So it was so incredible. Mm. The underground knew each other in both cities. And that's how you really found it. Yeah. Not like today, you know, where everyone, you can find out anything on social media. We didn't have that back then.
Mm-hmm. Susan Bartsch still throws a great party.
Oh, she was amazing.
It's so much fun.
I love Susan Bartsch. You know, but she'd bring out all these designers and all these clothes, and we would just soak it up, and they'll soak up some of the British energy as well.
Mm-hmm. What is there any fun moment you remember from early days of, like, you know, like your Kate, the Naomis, like the icons, like before they were the icons, like a moments of like you even like your early nights out, or like them going to places where it's like people didn't even know who they were, but they made sure people did know who they were.
I mean, I always talk about in my book when I talk about first meeting Kate, and I was modeling and I was 16, and I went to a casting, and you know, back then we had no cash, so that one job every model wanted it in London, and it was a Pepe job, and I went in, and you know, I was young, and you know, I was always so insecure anyway, I didn't even know why I was modeling. And I'm sitting there, this girl walks in, scraggly hair, sort of uneven teeth, but just literally, when I tell you, literally lit up the room. Even at that age, I was like, my God, that girl's the girl I've been seeing in the Face magazine. They've been shooting little pictures of her there, here and there. I'm like, that's a star. And then we became friends, and every nightclub, you see Kate smoking. Every nightclub, Kate smoking to drag you to her house, to go through her wardrobe. And before you know it, the sun was up. Kate always doing a fashion show. You know, she literally, and she still does it, outfit after outfit. And Naomi, we met in Paris when I was like, you know, I need to, there's this young model that everyone's talking about. And she's going up with Mike Tyson, so we need to get her for the cover. And I remember going to Paris, and we saw each other. She was so cute. She had the Whitney Houston curls, the moment when she had curls, that was 92, 93. And we did the shoot, and she's like, come with me. We're going to Dublin. You know, we have a plane. And I'm like, oh, yeah, I'd like to come. I had all but $20 in my pocket. So that didn't happen. But even then, she does something. We call it, you be Naomi. You can, you know, you pop down the road to visit Naomi. Before you know it, you're on a plane to India or China or wherever. You don't know what happened, how you got there, but you be Naomi. So.
I love that. when you first, you know, joined British Vogue, you know, what's going through your mind? You know, this is an institution, you know, and how did you want to shake it up? I mean, you had just come from Vogue Italia to like doing, I mean, I remember I was living the first year in New York, actually 2007 and 2008. But I remember running to the newsstand and getting the all black issue.
Oh yes,
everybody was talking about that. You know, like what when you came to British Vogue, like what were you like? I got to do this, and what were you like? We need to not do this anymore.
Yeah, I mean, for me, when I hit British Vogue, I'd been at Italian Vogue, I'd been at American Vogue, and I'd been at W. Mm-hmm. And for me, I just sort of an institution that needed to change. I looked around at all my friends, you know, they were all different races, different ages, different religious backgrounds, sexuality. I'm like, for me, a magazine has to reflect this. This is just what the world is. Mm-hmm. So I'm like, if I'm going to create a magazine, I'm going to create a magazine that showed beauty in all its colors, all its shapes and forms. And really, that's what I did. You know, and I remember I kept saying, you know, I'll probably get fired, but I don't care, because I'd rather get fired for what I believed in, what the world should be, than trying to, you know, tiptoe around what fashion should be. And in 2017, it wasn't a conversation that people were having, diversity or inclusivity. So fast forward, you know, and it was a huge, you know, in the beginning, there was pushback, but in the end, everybody accepted it. And now I look around at all the other magazines, and it's not a big deal having a, you know, a curvy girl or a gay woman or mm-hmm. or a woman in her 70s. And I feel like, you know, that was a good shakeup. That it needed to happen. Mm-hmm. So which is what we did, and I'm very, very, very proud of that. And what we stopped doing was mm-hmm. just make it all about one type of woman. You know, because that wasn't even good. That's not even good business when you think about it. Mm-hmm. So when people, you know, obviously, you know, if you can see it, you can be it. So British Vogue success really is that people see themselves in it every month, not in a special issue. Every month you open, mm-hmm. whatever, it's a rainbow coalition of incredible people. So I'm very proud of that.
Yeah. Two things I want to ask about that. One, it's so interesting that, you know, you had to talk about bringing in, like, you know, like, this inclusivity into the fashion world, because I feel like people who are raised on it and, you know, want to be a part of that world, like, and especially when you think of, like, middle America, what they think of the fashion world, they just think it's all, like, queer people, like, every kinds of, like, trans or, like, different identity. And it's interesting, you know, to even hear that, like, it wasn't that.
No.
You know? And from coming up where you were started out to where you started at British Vogue, like, was there a specific time or a magazine that you might have worked at or not worked at where you were like, that was a model of, like, what you thought the fashion industry should be? You know, like, was there one place that was, like, really getting it in, like, a sort of, like, it had a lot of different voices, or has it always sort of been stagnant?
You know what? Funny enough, the only magazine that had that when I was growing up was ID Magazine in the Face. Mm. And I remember, because I was part of it from so young, when you look at the work back then, it was like what we do now at British Vogue. It was all the races, all different ages, sizes, religions. And that's really what I carried on to British Vogue. You know, what the world looked like. I always say, you know, the world should really, fashion should reflect the world we live in. You know, so I've always carried that with me. Yeah, ID and the Face were kicking it back then, and they still are. And so really that's an ethos that I learned from a very young age, that fashion really should be inclusive. It should include everybody.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I love the Face. I did a Travis Scott profile for the Face cover, like, a few years ago.
Oh
yeah,
my that God, was, it's amazing.
Yeah, I love them. I love them over there. Yeah. The second one question is, you can't miss the fact that everyone is always like, the British Vogue covers are iconic, and it's always compared to American Vogue. What do you think is the, you know, sort of flavor that you have going on with the British Vogue covers, and why people love them? Like, they're having their moment this year and last year and everything. Like, people love a British Vogue cover. And what do you think, just, you know, American magazine covers are missing in general?
I mean, I feel like, you know, American Vogue, that's the great job that it's meant to do. And in England, you know, it's like we talked about the English, what we do in England is we always experiment. We, you know, mm-hmm. we don't have to sort of please millions and millions of people. So there's more room mm-hmm. for experimentation, and that's what we do. And we just go with our instincts. And, you know, we don't think, you know, we did the activist cover, and it was like a gatefold, black and white, of 30 activists on the biggest issue of the year. But, you know, we just, you know, like I said, we just take a lot of chances. And that's what we did from the very minute I started. It was about taking chances and showing a new way of mm-hmm. shooting covers. So,
I love that. When you sit down to write a book like this, what do you decide goes in? What do you decide you're leaving out? Like, what's the process of writing a book as opposed to, you know, guiding a book that is full of pieces that other people have created?
Yeah.
You know, this is your piece.
Yeah. I mean, obviously, you know, when you sit down to write about your life in any way, you must be prepared to let the world know the moments that matter. And there were so many moments, but I think they kind of came together naturally, because I started from when I was young and sort of ended now, you know, over 8 chapters. So I just, there were certain stories that I wanted to tell, that, you know, it wasn't just about the successes, but it was also about the failures in my life. You know, it was about the suffering, you know, sort of overwork, dealing with drinking when you're at a young age, you know, dealing with health issues because I have, you know, anemia. So those hard moments coupled with fun moments were very important. For me, I wanted to show the young generation basically that when you see somebody like yourself, myself, that's a story. Like, we didn't just get here. And that story wasn't just all about success. So for me, it was about visiting those stories that were really tough, as well as some fun moments. And there were too many fun moments. So, you know, might be another book. Who knows?
Yeah, I mean, we definitely need a big one with, like, photos and, like, you know, we need one of those. We need one of those moments, you know? I love a memoir that's also about someone who's worked in fashion. Were there any memoirs that sort of like inspired you as you were writing this, or ones that you've always, you know, just sort of like loved to read? And they don't even have to be fashion memoirs as well, like other memoirs that might have inspired you.
I mean, there were so many memoirs that I like. You know, I love Michelle Obama's memoir. I love Andrea Yontali's memoir. I even like Tina Brown's Vanity Fair Diaries. But I just knew that my story was so different, you know, sort of leaving, having to flee a country to another country, arriving, being penniless, I think my story was very different from everybody. So really, I wanted to write a book that sort of gave you an insight into fashion, but also just told young people or people who have always been seen as outside, people who've been othered, which is really what I was, Black, gay, working class, all that, that you can make it in your industry through sort of being resilient. So for me, that was really what was on my mind, that you can make it when the odds are stacked up against you. So yeah, it's a memoir, but it really, I think a lot of people expected, you know, here we go, this party, that party, this party. And that really wasn't was part of my story, but it wasn't really all of it.
I mean, what I really love about it is it's just very, it's very frank, but it's also very inspiring. You know, it's obviously, you know, like, you know, yeah, when you're othered, you never want to compare people just because, you know, they're just because they're both Black, just because they're both gay, just because they've both been in the industry, you know. But it's, I feel like it's not hard to read this after having read, you know, like Andre's, you know, book. And, you know, I compare this a bit more to, when after he passed, you know, and, you know, people were talking about the chiffon trenches, you know, like some of the sadness of that. This has reminded me a bit more of, you know, like ALT, like his original memoir.
Original,
you know, that one had so much promise and hope in it.
People forgot really about ALT, right? It was a good one.
Yeah.
And Andre,
You know,
Andre was so kind to me. Like when I was, you know, I was the only one in Europe, essentially. And I was the only token, if you want to say that. But, you know, like I said, I brought my friends with me. I brought Pat McGrath, who was my best friend, and Naomi, and, you know, Ben Skirvin. And we became a little crew in the fashion industry. And Andre was always kind to me, always had kind words for me, supportive words, you know. And I always say, if it wasn't him, I wouldn't be here, because he paved the way. And he was the only one, really, of his generation, too.
Yeah. Lastly, I just want to ask, you know, besides fashion and your work, like, what else in the arts, what creatively inspires you?
Oh, my God.
You
know? I mean, I love a lot of art, which is really, really sort of inspiring to me. I mean, Lynette Yardom's incredible, you know. I love, like, old ones, like Wang Getchi. So the art world always inspires me, but also music inspires me. I feel like we're in what I call the great flat. Well, you know, we do fashion, music, film, all go hand in hand. You know, I'm inspired by culture, anything under the umbrella of culture. So it could be a good movie. It could be a good film, a good book. You know, I'm just always curious. I think you can't lose curiosity.
Well, thank you so much for being here.
Thank you for having me.
A Visible Man. Yes, people need to read it. Thank you for being here on the show.
Oh, yes. My pleasure. I hope to meet you soon.
A Visible Man, a memoir, is out now wherever you get your books.
You like to watch new stuff, right? Well, go to Hulu and see what's new, because Hulu has new stuff all the time. Like Vanderpump Villa, the new docudrama starring Lisa Vanderpump, where first-class luxury meets world-class drama. A new season of The Kardashians, starring The Kardashians, of course. And Grand Cayman, Secrets in Paradise, the sizzling new reality show set in the tropical Caribbean. It's all new, and it's streaming now on Hulu.
Here you are. BPMs high, sweat dripping, body moving, tongue panting. You're working hard, real hard, and you're thirsty. You need vitamins, nutrients for peak performance and energy.
And your plants do too. Aw, I mean, just look at the little guy. Water-soluble plant food from Miracle-Gro is full of essential nutrients. Just a little scoop into your watering can and boom, instant feeding and bigger, more beautiful plants. It's kind of like a sports drink for your plants. You may have to suffer from heat, but your plants do not.
How about Cap'n Crunch's Crunch Berries with breakfast?
Whoa, Dad, we're on
Crunch Island. It's John LeFoot.
And he stole our crunch.
Quick, the zip line.
He's getting away.
Throw our last Crunch Berry.
No!
No one steals my Crunch Berries.
I think you mean my Crunch Berries. Choose your own Crunch Venture with Cap'n Crunch.
Queen Elizabeth II. She's dead.
This is me finding out right now.
Oh, I'm so sorry.
Damn it.
I know you were such a fan. She died on Thursday at the age of 96 after a statement was released saying the Queen's doctors are concerned for Her Majesty's health. Various members of the royal family rushed to her Scottish home and her death was announced later that day. And let's just say, she'd been dying for a minute.
She must have been.
I mean, come on.
Also, what a strange cryptic statement.
There's no way she was
rushed
to the hospital.
Yeah.
And then all of a sudden, people arrive there within seconds.
No, the statement being like, oh, they're concerned for her health. Oh, now you are? Minutes before she died? Liars.
Yeah. Anyway, a lot going on this week.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And it brought out a lot of insane people.
Well, also everybody had like the expected takes, like how can you mourn this woman when she presided over this and this, like we don't know, the royals are, you know, historically a trash heap, whatever, but and whatever, like I expect that, so it that,
yeah.
I'm not saying I'm unhappy to see it or mad to see it, I expected to see it, but you were never going to get like uniform let's have a merry parade in this woman's honor.
Right, which is good, you know, and like people deserve to be angry with the crown and colonialism, and it's actually wild how many people came out in defense of like you must revere the crown and like the monarchy, and I'm like, okay, some of you are American and this is very weird.
Yeah, no, I this will be the first and last time I ever drag this person, but Liz Phair had a very bizarre tweet being like, shut up, the Queen's been wonderful for 70 years. I was like, what? Elizabeth Clark Phair? What is happening? The Winnetka, Illinois jumped out. Yeah.
She blocked me.
What?
So I don't know if she's going to be coming on Keep It anytime soon. I responded.
Oh, no. No, you didn't. Think of me.
I responded, well, that's not very whip smart of you.
Unfortunately funny. Unfortunately. Great album, by the way. I literally have it on my wall behind me. If you're watching the YouTube show, you can see Whip Smart right there.
If you play it backwards, you can hear the Queen's Christmas address from 1984.
Okay.
Liz's whole record, favorite. Huh? Her yeah. favorite. Sandra Bernhardt, too.
What did she do?
She tweeted about the Queen.
No, she's done a couple of dubious things over the past 15, 20 yeah. years, too. So that's sort of, that scans. I was surprised by Liz.
Yeah. I was like, what is going on, baby? I really will say that, like, people who are obsessed with the monarchy and the crown, it's baffling. They're like, there was a report that the viewership of The Crown jumped up by 400% over the weekend.
like you were going to get new information about the queen from this very dramatized series.
The people who turn it on thinking, oh, like she died. Like, was that the last episode that happened?
Right. Yeah. Oh, this is the news now. I'll just turn it on. Claire Foy, though, one of the definitive performances, not just as the queen, but royalty performances ever. I mean, when The Crown came out, I almost feel like we were inundated with news about how lavish it was. And we were unsure because it was slow moving. We're like, is there any like actual historical interest here enough to make it good? And this show is fucking amazing. Like, we'll be watching the Crown for years and years and years.
Mm-hmm. Who else have you loved who've played the queen?
The queen. Well, 2006 is a very specific best actress year. It's when Helen Mirren won for the queen. But really, there is an argument for everybody in that category. And I think that's the year I go back and forth on the most, because you've got Kate Winslet in Little Children, arguably one of her deepest performances ever on screen. You've got Meryl Streep in The Devil Wears Prada. Literally, the only knock against her is maybe that's not a lead performance. But of course, it's the iconic performance from that movie, and certainly her most devastating comic performance. You've got Volver, Penelope Cruz. Come on. I mean, like, Almodovar underrepresented in Oscar history anyway. And then that performance, so lived in, so fabulous. And then you've got Judi Dench in Notes on a Scandal, which, has a lesbian ever been more terrifying?
That's fair. You know what?
Outside of Sandra Bernhardt.
Mine might be shocking.
Go ahead.
Vanessa Redgrave.
Oh, in Mary Queen of Scots or what?
In Pixar's Cars. She played the Cars.
I just want to say
the queen.
The amount of credit I gave you, that I thought you had seen the movie Mary Queen of Scots, and you are talking about fucking Cars. I have not seen Cars. Go ahead, explain what she achieves in Cars.
She achieves a kind of presence and tenacity that will, you know, it's there were essays written about it in Cahiers de Cinema.
I'm sure. Is it a post-it note you slid into a Cahiers de Cinema?
It is. It was when I interned there briefly.
Oh, yeah. They're like, we got to get rid of this guy. What does he work for? BuzzFeed? He should work there.
But no, I also would agree, you know, obviously, you know. I like Kristin Scott Thomas.
Just like her anyway. I like when she turns up on a red carpet looking wacky.
Yeah. I've seen clips of it, but she played the queen in the audience, like on stage. So,
correct. I think my favorite performance of a royal ever still, I want to say we've talked about this best actress here too. In fact, I already brought up Gene Simmons earlier tonight. Genevieve Bujold in Anne of the Thousand Days. Have you ever seen this movie?
No.
Okay, so it's her as Anne Boleyn. And Richard Burton as Henry VIII. And it basically treats Anne Boleyn like she's crazy like a fox. She's somebody who's obsessed with power. And then, of course, obviously she gets beheaded eventually. But she's trying to wrest power. And she's like scheming and using the people around the king. And for a 3-hour movie, and it is literally 3 hours, she is amazing. And also, I mean, we've seen Genevieve Bujold in like Dead Ringers. She's in House of Yes, if you remember that movie.
Mm-hmm. But yes,
this movie, it's just so much fun watching her try to correct history, basically trying to outsmart, you know, a world of men that she's surrounded by. And I don't know that I'd give her the win that year, because that's Maggie Smith in the prime of Miss Jean Brody. And as I've said, previously, that role is basically Mary Poppins for gay bastards.
Listen, you're talking about Anne Boleyn, and we're talking about other royals. Like, one of my favorite trashy films is The Other Boleyn Girl.
I don't think I've seen it.
Natalie Portman, Scarlett Johansson, Eric Bana. That movie is beautiful trash.
What happens in the other Bolin
Kristen Scott Thomas plays Elizabeth Bolin in it. You've got Jim Sturgess. You've got Mark Rylance. You've got Eddie Redmayne, Juno Temple. Andrew Garfield's in it.
While we're on this topic, can I formally request that Mark Rylance stop dressing like a silent film star? I find it annoying and creepy. You'll just see like an ensemble of actors. It's like, oh, who's Stan Laurel over there? Oh, it's Mark Rylance and is dressed like the fucking Monopoly guy.
Yeah, you know, it's sort of about, you know, the alleged incest and everything that happened, you know, Anne, and, you know, when she's imprisoned. And I think it's fun and I think it's trashy. And Peter Morgan did the screenplay, so.
Oh, well, we love that. Peter Morgan is trustworthy in this department.
Yeah, but the director is Justin Chadwick, who did, God, do you remember Tulip Fever?
I mean, I certainly didn't see it, but I remember I remember the curiousness of that movie finally being delayed. It was delayed all these years. It was mostly a bland movie. All the critics were like, you know, you forget it as soon as you leave the theater or whatever. But it was released so late. I don't know what year, like 2015, 16 or whatever.
2017. Like literally right before we started the show.
Yeah. 2017. And Matthew Morrison was in it. And I'm not saying Matthew Morrison is incapable of booking a role, but it's the kind of role you get because you're on a hit show at the time. And obviously Glee had long ended. So it was very strange seeing him in that movie.
And, you know, like Alicia Vikander's in that. And she was probably like, why now?
Yeah. She's like, I'm not doing much right now. Please.
Let it die. And of course, that was, you know, that was the last film released by the Weinstein Company. And, you know, that was like Harvey's obsession.
Yes, yes, of course, of course. And Judi Dench is still in it, the one-time Harvey super associate, mega associate. Basically, the reason he is associated with Prestige, he made Judi Dench happen.
Yeah, you know, she'll pay for her crimes.
I cannot get over how she said, I can't do the James Bond movies anymore. After all, I'm blind. And she has since done 70 movies where she sees perfectly fine since. She's like, carry on. She's like, I'll do Belfast, whatever. Put me in that Murder on the Orient Express shit. I don't care. Yeah.
Just scamming.
Yeah, no.
Who amongst us wouldn't lie to get out of the Bond franchise?
No, I mean, it's as close to Marvel jail as you can be in while, you know, being associated with novels of the past.
Yeah.
Judi Dench's Marvel universe.
Well, I think that's all we have to say about the Queen. Let's cast Camilla.
Oh, God.
The definitive Camilla.
Well, what age do you want
her? Like, biopic.
What age do you want her?
I want... my Camilla story has to be like after Diana's death. I think mine would be more of like a Jackie.
Got it. How do we feel about Vera Farmiga?
Mm.
I also feel like Vera Farmiga has a lightly dotty thing about her that would just suit any British performance, let alone the cool take I want on Camilla.
Mm-hmm. I'm like looking at her in 95 and, you know, she had a bit of a, I'm writing letters into the broadcasting company because there was an interracial romance on my television screen. Look to her face.
Sure.
You know?
That look. Yes.
Yeah. Oof. Yeah. She's like a stern face too.
Which is important.
Unfortunately, whoever plays her is going to be hotter than she actually is, but.
We'll allow it. Fine. Whatever.
Yeah.
The hair is what's important. She's really got that. Sometimes it's flared out, but sometimes it's really got that Bunny McDougal from Sex and the City thing, which, you know, classic.
Let some other woman do a little like Charlize Theron and Monster moment, though. You know, like ugly themselves up a bit.
Uh-huh. Like really get into character. Yeah. But I feel like she has kind of like a naughty humor, right? Well, we overheard that weird exchange with Charles where they were joking about, what was it, tampons or something?
Yeah.
So something's going on. Again, Dottie is the word.
Okay. How old was she then?
She would have been about 48.
Well, adultery ages you. God don't like ugly.
No.
Camila.
Jesus Christ. God don't like ugly. That's Ira's advice.
That's the tagline. Camila. God don't like ugly.
Actually, I think she looks chic as fuck, to be honest, but I also thought Queen Elizabeth throughout the ages always had a cool look. I was just like the look on her face always felt kind of rad and self-possessed.
Yeah. All right. Well,
I'm a royalist ultimately. They've made no mistakes and I support them.
Respond to us, you know, if you have your own ideas of who should play Camila.
Yes, thank you.
Yeah. All right. When we're back, keep it. And we're back with our favorite segment of the episode. It is Keep It. Lewis, what's yours?
I just want to say about the Keep It segment in general that while we're having a fun time on this podcast, sometimes the Keep It is not that fun. Okay. And it's a moment of serious self-reflection for me. And you know how like Garfield gets on the stage and then waits for the tomatoes? It's one of those. So just be prepared. Keep It. To Barack Obama's presidential portrait. Guys, I know he wanted something different, but when they unveiled that thing and it was Barack in front of a white backdrop, you guys, it's giving Excedrin commercial. Guys, we're talking about the White House right now. That looks like something that hangs in the Paley Center. I looked at this thing and plenty of things set him apart from other presidents, even just as it pertains to this podcast, actually cares about pop culture in a cool way. When he puts out that movie list, it's not a try hard list. He clearly has seen everything and picks his favorite. He's an unexpectedly huge Brandy Carlisle fan, like actual taste going on with this former president. So when I saw this portrait, I wanted to sign on and sign on specifically to the fact that it is different from all these other ones. But man, a white backdrop. You're the president of the United States. You're not Candace Bergen for Sprint. It doesn't look good.
It's from Robert McCurdy, and his portraits tend to have a bit of a Humans of New York feel to them.
Yeah. Uh-huh. I could have embraced that in certain circumstances, but here, I mean, it looks like he's just, you know, selling us car insurance or something.
Yeah. I don't, you know what? And I also don't love Michelle's either.
It's okay. I mean, like that one at least has color in it, you know? So, mm-hmm. Which I'm sure, you know, I don't mean to shame Mamie Eisenhower, but I'm sure Michelle is giving more color and more personality than maybe first ladies of the past did. So I'm happy to see that represented. But
of course. And yeah. That's from Sharon Sprung. I just feel like Sharon's like are a bit more dynamic in her other work, and the Michelle one just seems a bit, I'm like, who's she looking at? the you know, and like it doesn't feel like her, she feels a bit cartoonish in it, you know? Mm. Like it's not fully realized to me, but maybe I just love the last one so much, the Amy Sherrill one.
Wait, and I loved his, the one in the garden. That was so awesome. And like, whoa, you'll never forget that, you know?
Yeah, the Kehinde Wiley one. That one was gorgeous. That one was like, that was art.
Correct.
You know, she's always trying something new, that Barack.
Right. But as it stands, it's like Barack is looking at us and saying, happy Honda days. And I don't want to celebrate. Ira, what right. is your keep it? Save us.
My keep it goes to Boy Meets World star Ben Savage, who is running for West Hollywood City Council currently.
He sure is. And that makes me think, he's just my neighbor or something? Can I peek out the window, look at this BevMo, and check out Corey Matthews walking in and picking up some mics hard?
Yeah, I'm like, where do you live, Ben? I assumed he had other things to do with his life. You know, his brother's career's in ruins.
It sure is.
So, yeah. So I figured, you know, he'd be dealing with family issues. But listen, the name of the game in politics is when your family is in turmoil, that's the time for you to step up.
Well, let me tell you something. I've not really checked in with Ben Savage in a number of years, so maybe he'll be unexpectedly amazing or a political mastermind or whatever. I mean, I don't have any updates on him other than it would be funny. Go ahead. Do you have one?
A few weeks ago, he posted an Instagram story of him hanging out with the LA County Sheriff's deputies.
We love them.
And, you know, he is a friend of the police. So,
good Lord, God. Okay, whatever. Exciting. Really exciting. No, wouldn't it be amazing, though, if, like, he had detractors on the board and every time they disagreed with him, they brought out, like, Mr. Feeney to scold him? Come on, that'd be fun.
That would actually be very funny. But, you know, I'm like, I don't need Corey Matthews being pro-cop and running for office in West Hollywood. What are you doing?
No.
Also, and is it like a dream? Like, as you said, like, I don't associate him with West Hollywood. So, like, what is this? Is this like a stepping stone to run for other things in the future? I'm very suspicious.
And also, I mean, West Hollywood, he's going to be presiding over some really faggoty issues. I mean, has he expressed any mastery of this subject once upon a time? Like, does he know where I'm going to park when the parade hits? I don't know.
Well, he said that West Hollywood is the best city on earth and that West Hollywood Mayor Lauren Meister needs some backup and that WeHo needs a clear set of eyes and someone with no attachments.
Okay. I believe it needs 3 more Starbucks. So let's get on that.
I believe the bars need to be open till 4 a.m.
Yeah, that concerns me. Yeah, if I'm at Mickey's, I need that person writhing on the pole till at least 3:46. Okay.
Anyway, my keep it's to him. I also have another side keep it that disappoints me to say.
Oh, but, go ahead.
I don't know what's going on with Rina Sawayama's current song releases, but they're not for me.
Oh, that's too bad.
And This Hell was amazing. And the other ones, I want to know what's going on. I want to know what she's going through. They're giving a little Disney Channel original movie soundtrack.
Interesting. So she's veering away from the, you know, Evanescence.
Less of the industrial, like, hardcore. I'm just like, it seems it's very earnest. I just want to know what's going on.
Yeah. Earnest. Not the same thing as having a good time.
Not a keep it, but not a keep it up. Just a, keep us in the loop.
Yeah. Keep us informed.
Yeah. I just want to know what you're going through, sis.
We want to understand. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. If there's like a greater plan here, you know, I'm happy to hear it.
Great.
But right now, you know, I'm not finding any perks in being a wallflower.
That's so interesting. I want to add also that I'm confused about Kelly Clarkson and Dolly Parton. When they put out I'm going to generously call it a ballad version of 9 to 5, were they thinking, I think what this song needs is for the fun to be wrung out of it like a rag. And instead, we'll just not dance and, I guess, you know, meditate on the shittiness of the workplace. That's just all we got out of that song. Okay, great.
Late stage capitalism has taken, you know, 9 to 5, which was a call to arms. And now it's the song you hear when you're on hold. Yeah. calling your 9 to 5 to call out. Because you're sick.
Right. Literally waiting for your ship to come in while you're on hold. Yes.
Yeah.
Just questions. All right. That's all we have.
Yeah. Just keep us in the loop.
We'll talk to you later.
She's never coming on this podcast again. No. She hates me now. At any rate, thank you to Edward Innenfold for being here this week. And remember to check out full episodes of Keep It on the Uncultured YouTube channel. Despite the name, it is a very cultured YouTube channel. And don't forget to rate and review Keep It on your podcast platform of choice. Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Google Play, Stitcher, HBO Max Discovery. I don't know. Wherever you get Keep It. We'll see you soon with more Keep It. Keep It is a Crooked Media production. Our senior producer is Kendra James. Our producer is Chris Lord. Our executive producers are Ira Madison III
and Louis Fertel.
Our editor is Charlotte Landis, and Kyle Seglin is our sound engineer.
Thank you to our digital team, Matt DeGroot, Nara Malkonian, and Delon Villanueva for our production support every week.
Hi, it's Martha Stewart. You know, I spend a lot of time thinking about dirt. At 3 a.m., at all hours of the day, really. What people don't know is that not all dirt is the same. You need dirt with the right kind of nutrients. New Miracle-Gro organic raised bed and garden soil is so dense, so full of nutrient-rich, high-quality ingredients. Miracle-Gro is simply the best.
Whether you're a morning person or a bedtime procrastinator, everyone deserves a mattress that works for their style. And you'll find the best mattress for you at Ashley. The new Tempur-Adapt collection at Ashley brings you one-of-a-kind body-conforming technology, making every sleep tailored to be your best. The collection also features cool-to-the-touch covers and motion absorption to help minimize sleep disruptions from partners, pets, or kids. Shop the all-new Tempur-Adapt collection at Ashley in-store or online at ashley.com. Ashley. For the love of home.